From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Soon, all new cars will be required to be equipped to talk to one another, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration said this week. And right behind that announcement sits the push for self-driving cars. Long science fiction stuff. That push is now very much in gear. It will change a lot about the way we move and live. This hour On Point, on the road to self-driving cars. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Are you up for this future? Punch in a destination and take a snooze. Will it come? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. We'll turn in a moment to the wide world, the big future of driverless cars on the road, and how one of the biggest auto suppliers in the world, Delphi, is preparing for that future. But first, to this week's announcement. Tom Costello, its correspondent for NBC News, joins me from Washington. He covers transportation, consumer affairs, and more. Was in Ann Arbor, Michigan, when the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration kicked off testing for so-called vehicle-to-vehicle communication. He's driven cars equipped with V2V technology. Tom Costello, welcome to On Point. Thanks very much for being here.
Nice to be here, Tom.
Why is the NHTSA pushing on this now, this week?
I'll make it easy on you. Just call it NHTSA.
Okay.
The reason is because the Department of Transportation really believes that the technology is there already. And I must tell you that most major car manufacturers believe it, too. They've already been working on this for many years. So let's separate out two different issues here. Vehicle-to-vehicle communication, where car A talks to car B and car C and car D. And because they're all talking to each other on the road, they know where each other is going and what's happening, and therefore they can hopefully avoid an accident if you, the driver, fail to avoid an accident.
Mm-hmm.
That's separate from a fully autonomous car. So let's separate that out.
Absolutely.
As for V2V, what the Department of Transportation is saying, what NHTSA is saying, is that we believe the technology is so close to being ready for prime time here. And in fact, they just did this 12-month program in Ann Arbor, as you mentioned, with 3,000 vehicles in the city. And they tested it, and it seemed to work very well. And they had multiple vendors. In other words, they had Audi, and they had Volkswagen and Mercedes, and as well as, of course, Ford and some of the others. I was in a Ford car trying it out. They think that now what needs to happen is the government needs to set the general parameters for these different car manufacturers to begin working on the platforms by which they will communicate out on the open road out across the country. The government is not setting up the infrastructure, importantly. But what they are going to say is, okay, we're going to transmit on this particular frequency. We're going to have these bandwidth parameters. Somebody needs to set the guidelines and the rules so that everybody else can play.
Tom, what's the range of data or information that they anticipate cars will be communicating to one another? Like what?
They're literally talking about being able to transmit 10 pieces of data every second. And it will be everything from your car position via GPS to how well you brake, how you are braking, are you hitting ice, are you turning left, are you turning right, are you speeding, all of that information constantly transmitted in a radius of about 300 yards or so, maybe more, and other cars in the vicinity picking up all that information. It all amalgamates in each other's computers, and the cars are saying, okay, I know that this guy's coming in from the left, and I know he's got a brake to hit the red light. If he doesn't hit his brakes, he's going to go right through that red light, and he's going to T-bone me. And in fact, that's what happened to me. I was in Ann Arbor, and I was on a test track, and a car, we knew this was going to happen, but a car blew his red light, and before I got up to my green light, my brakes, I got LED warnings, my seat rumbled, and I got a slight tap on the brake telling me, hey, watch out, something's coming, and you may not be ready for it.
So when the information comes in, communicated car to car, is it primarily to alert the driver, the human, to do something, or is the idea that the cars themselves will respond, react?
I think that we're talking about both. In the most primitive forms, it would be a driver alert, and that's frankly most of what I experienced. I got flashing LED lights, my seat would rumble, and it's interesting, on your left side or your left cheek would rumble if the threat's coming in from the left. Your right cheek rumbles if it's coming in from the right. You also get an audible warning. It can be a beeping, it could be a computer voice saying, caution or alert or something like that. But we have already seen the technology in place, and it was advertised on Super Bowl Sunday, of course, in which a car slams on its brakes on its own because you, the driver, and in this case it was a 17-year-old boy distracted by a cute girl, didn't realize he's about to plow into somebody. All of this technology exists already. Mostly it exists in the form of sensors and radars, which many of us have on our cars already, to prevent us from hitting the guy in front of us if we're in that kind of a specific mode, cruise control mode. But now this is taking it to the next level and literally communicating with each other.
What's the timetable for all new cars to have this, Tom?
This is important. I'm glad you raised it. There was a little bit of confusion and misinformation or misreporting on this topic. What the Department of Transportation is saying is it wants to have the rule in place by the time the Obama administration leaves office. It does. It's not telling you you have to have the technology in place. It wants the rule in place. And the rule will state that car companies have to have the technology on new cars by X date. They haven't given that date yet because they want to be able to work through public input. They also want to hear from the car manufacturers and get everybody on board. I suspect we're probably looking at 5 to 10 years past 2016. So somewhere in the neighborhood of 2021, 2025, somewhere in there, if the DOT and NHTSA go forward with this, and it's, you know, there aren't massive lawsuits, if this goes forward, I suspect we're talking in probably 5 to 10 to 12 years before this now becomes standard required.
It obviously works best if all cars have it, but they're talking new cars. What about retrofitting cars already on the road? Might that be required or not?
I don't think you could ever require that, and they would never attempt that. Almost all of these major advancements in safety come from new technology being introduced to new cars. You know, look at what's happened with airbags. I mean, the drop in fatalities in this country and traffic fatalities is remarkable and attributable mostly to better built cars, but most importantly, airbags, and then second from that, much better construction of roads, and, you know, we've now got roundabouts and better on-roads and off-ramps and that kind of thing. But what this marks is a big shift. Rather than trying to make sure you survive a crash, they want to make sure you never have a crash, and that hopefully the technology is there to the point that they can do that.
Tom, everybody thinks about driving a little differently. What about you? You've experienced it in Ann Arbor. Do you welcome this in your next car somewhere down the road?
Yeah, I think so. Listen, I can tell you that I've got on my car, I've got the backup camera, I've got the sensors, for backing up and going forward so I don't hit the trash can or, God forbid, hit a little kid behind me that I don't see. I really welcome that. It's only, I think, enhanced safety in my case. And I have had, I think everybody, when they have a car, over the course of their car, they may bump the bumper a couple of times at least. I haven't had it happen to me once in the last two cars I've had, and that's because I think I've got these sensors. So I can only imagine that the safety entire picture will dramatically improve for me and probably for everybody else.
Tom Costello with NBC News joining us from Washington today. Tom, thanks so much for sharing your experience.
My pleasure.
In a press conference Monday, Transportation Secretary Anthony Fox talked about these vehicle-to-vehicle communications, V2V, and its potential benefits.
Keeping drivers safe is the most important advantage of V2V, but it's also just one of many. V2V can also help reduce congestion and save fuel. The potential of this technology is absolutely enormous.
Many look at that potential and say, well, once we've got that, how long before we actually have self-driving cars talking to one another? It's a kind of foundation technology, potentially, for that next phase. There's a lot of planning going on already. Burkhardt Bilger joins us. He's written about it for The New Yorker. His latest piece in the magazine is headlined, Autocorrect, Has the Self-Driving Car at Last Arrived? Joins us from New York. Burkhardt Bilger, thanks very much for being with us.
It's good to be here, Tom.
This is not pie-in-the-sky talk anymore. There are a lot of companies and people making very real plans and developing technology for the self-driving car, Burkhardt.
Not at all. It's very much an ongoing idea. And I think Tom Costello's timeline that he was saying 5 to 10 to 15 years is actually, Google would say that's pessimistic. I think they think they're going to have a fully operable model within the next 5 years.
Who's driving the push now? Is it Detroit? Is it Google? Are they on the same page? Is there a consensus that this is where we'll eventually go with personal transportation or not?
Well, everybody has had their ongoing programs in this. It's a little bit different if you think of something like GPS. There were you had groups like Navtech, of course, who did most of the research themselves, and then Google took over and has done even better with GPS. Whereas the car manufacturers didn't do so much with that, and then they eventually just put their skin on this existing technology from a third party. With driverless cars, it's different. I mean, all these major manufacturers have had programs in driverless car technology for 10 to 20 years. What they've done is just used bits and pieces of it and implemented that into their cars. You know, of course, like cruise control, like automatic braking and so forth. What Google has said is, this is too slow. We want to do the whole shebang. We don't want to wait and do this incremental progress. We want to get a fully operational self-driving car going.
They're working on it. Is Detroit cooperating, saying, yes, let's do it, or saying, we're not so sure?
Well, it's an interesting pas de deux they've got going on. I mean, I think Google's ideal situation would have been that Detroit, you know, buy their technology or license their technology from them. And Detroit is saying, on the one hand, no, we've got our own thing. We don't want to use your stuff. On the other hand, they're saying Google is ahead of us, and that worries us for a number of reasons. It worries us because what if they don't implement it well and it's not as good as it needs to be to convince the public? And also it worries us because what if they get all the profits from this and we're left in the cold?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the push to get cars talking to each other and then cars driving themselves. V2V, vehicle-to-vehicle communication, and one day, self-driving cars. Burkhard Bilger is with us. He's written about it for The New Yorker magazine. He joins us today from New York. People have talked about it for a long time, all the way back in the 1930s. We're getting closer now. Here's from 1956, the Motorama Auto Show. General Motors produced a short film advertisement called Key to the Future, which predicted self-driving cars in the far-off future of 1976.
We're all set for auto control.
Roger, Firebird 2. Move to electronic control strip in center lane.
Okay, that was then. Now we're much more into the detail. Here's Sebastian Thrun, one of the engineers that helped build Google's driverless car, gave a TED talk a couple of years ago on the future world of the self-driving car. Here he is talking about the detail of precision and safety in that future.
Driving accidents are the number one cause of death for young people. And do you realize that almost all of those are due to human error and not machine error? And can therefore be prevented by machines? Do you realize that we could change the capacity of highways by a factor of two or three if we didn't rely on human precision on staying in the lane, but on robotic precision, and thereby drive a little bit closer together, on a little bit narrower lanes, and do away with all traffic jams on highways?
Robotic precision in the self-driving car future. Not everybody is so sure it's going to be so great. Last March, TEDx Zwolle in the Netherlands, Peter Phelps, futurologist at the Institute for Mobility Research, a research facility of BMW, talked about the positive effects, but also pointed out possible negative effects of self-driving cars.
We can expect that the average commute length will get longer, because people don't mind anymore sitting in the car for longer distances or for longer time when they can do something different while driving. Also, the number of cars is increased. For example, the affluent families, they not only have a car for the mother and the father, but also one or more cars for the children. And also the older people, they continue to drive longer when they get older because it's easier for them to be driven around by the car.
Burke Bilger with The New Yorker. What do you think? Driving heaven or driving hell when we get to self-driving cars, if and when we get there?
Well, it gets really hard to predict what's going to be the impact on the size of the fleet. I mean, I think you can make just as good an argument, which Sergey Brin does at Google, that the number of cars will decrease dramatically.
Why?
If you think about it, look at New York City. I mean, 90% of the cars that you see are used. I mean, almost anybody's car. How much do you actually use it? Maybe 5% of the day? Maybe 10% if you have a long commute? Now, imagine that instead of everybody owning a car, those, you know, a number of cars were group owned and were able to kind of divide their time among all these people using their 5% differently. Suddenly, I mean, it becomes the idea of a kind of a individualized mass transit system almost.
But that would be maybe fewer cars existing, but no fewer cars on the road at any given time. If it's just cars being used all the time automatically.
Sure, but they might not be parked on the street. They might be in a common parking lot.
Yeah.
If there are a few cars overall, then you would have, in general, fewer cars on the street. So, I mean, I think it's hard to determine what the feedback loops would be. And there's that old conundrum that the bigger highways you build, the more cars go on them, and your capacity always rises. You know, your number of cars rises to meet your capacity. So it's hard to know exactly what would happen. But I do think the benefits that are obvious and hard to imagine not happening are the safety ones. I mean, we have 50 million injuries per year worldwide, 1.24 million deaths. If you can, you know, cut that by 90%, it's a huge change in just human safety. So that part of it, I think, is I find most appealing as a driver.
We're going to hear more about the law and requirements there to allow this to happen, more on technology in a moment. What are Google's aspirations here in terms of their goal? Is it fully autonomous? I just jump into some kind of a pod and it whisks me away? Or do they picture the driver still at the wheel and ready to intervene or take over if the robot fails?
No, I mean, they're looking for full autonomy. You know, absolutely, the car kind of assumes that you would be sitting behind the wheel, certainly in the near term, and can take over. And it will give you, I mean, what they're looking for now in 5 or 10 years is a car that can actually pull itself over to the curb if there's a catastrophic failure. So in some ways, you don't absolutely need somebody behind the wheel. But for now, there's still a big red button on the dash that you hit if everything goes wrong, and the human driver is always able to take over. But I think their idea is explicitly against this incrementalism. They want to do the whole shebang, and they think it's well within our reach.
First comes vehicle-to-vehicle communication. That is being put up on the rails right now. Once you've got V2V, you're a whole lot closer to the potential for self-driving cars. Burkhard Bilger, please stand by in New York. Bryant Walker-Smith joins us right now from Stanford, California, big thinker on the legal issues around autonomous driving, self-driving cars, fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School, fellow at the Center for Automotive Research at Stanford, lecturer in law at Stanford Law School. Bryant Walker-Smith, thanks a lot for being with us. Welcome back to our ongoing conversation on the self-driving car at On Point. Has there been legal progress since we last talked a year or two ago?
Yes. In many ways, this has gotten down to the fun level of government bureaucrats.
Oh, boy.
So a year or two ago, we talked about Nevada as the first state to have passed a law, and then Nevada's Department of Motor Vehicles coming up with rudimentary rules for research and development testing. Since then, we've seen Florida, D.C., California, and Michigan pass legislation regulating these vehicles, and more states considering it, as well as California conducting an ongoing and extensive rulemaking process of its own, and the federal government through the Department of Transportation issuing some policy guidance to all of the states. Regulators are thinking about this hard.
How are they thinking about it? What's the vision that legislators, regulators have in mind when they think about a future of potential self-driving cars?
Well, in many cases, they're turning to industry and academia and saying, what can we realistically expect and what do you need? So some of the legislation that we've seen, which has been developed with the strong influence of Google and to a lesser extent the traditional automotive industry, codifies this real traditional sense of what a car is. It's, you know, 2 tons and there's a steering wheel and there's a person behind it. And at some level, it is driving itself. The open question is, well, what is the human doing? Are they still required to pay attention as a technical matter? Are they required to pay attention as a legal matter? These are questions that will be driven by the technology and haven't been resolved. But they're thinking, well, what should be required to test? Where should these be allowed? Who should be allowed to operate them in this research and development phase?
What are the big legal challenges here? Is it mainly about liability? I've seen surveys of Americans about self-driving cars. They're apprehensive, and liability comes up right away. If the car's driving itself, the robot's driving, who's responsible?
Absolutely. Well, Responsibility is this broad issue, and anyone who uses the road is, in a sense, responsible for doing so safely. So a person who takes out a vehicle with advanced driver assistance systems or ultimately with the ability to drive itself, well, they have to do so in a responsible manner. And so the question that people are struggling with is what is responsible at this point? And what is the appropriate level of safety that we can expect from these technologies and that we should demand from these technologies and that we can demonstrate with these technologies? 30,000 people die on the roads every year in the United States. Any technology that replicated that level of success would be a failure. It would be simply too unsafe. So these technologies have to perform better than humans. And the open questions are, A, how much better, and B, how is that demonstrated?
But nothing's perfect. Sooner or later, even with self-driving cars, the robot runs somebody over, runs them down. When that happens, who's likely to be responsible?
Ultimately, consumers are going to pay for the cost of crashes. But the question is, how do we get back to those consumers? So imagine a crash where a human is using a self-driving car. Perhaps it can drive on the freeway, but not in snow, not in difficult traffic conditions. And there's a crash and there's someone injured. Well, the vehicle owner and operator is going to get sued, and their insurance is probably going to pay. Perhaps they were negligent in using or supervising it. The real pressing question for manufacturers is, well, how much are manufacturers also liable? Perhaps the vehicle made a poor decision or it failed to deal with a foreseeable road event. Well, that would be a design defect for which the manufacturer would be liable. Perhaps the manufacturer knew that the driver would get distracted, wouldn't pay attention like they were supposed to, wouldn't be really mentally aware to take over when the vehicle needed it, and failed to warn the user about that. Well, that would also come back to the manufacturer for a failure to anticipate that foreseeable situation. And then ultimately, the consumer would pay for that through a higher vehicle cost. The challenge now is understanding those risks, those technical, legal, and broad industry reputational risks, so that they can be priced into vehicles.
I want to go to Auburn Hills, Michigan right now, and John Absmeyer. He's director of the Silicon Valley Innovation Center for Delphi Automotive, the big Michigan-based auto supplier. He's been spending a lot of time out in California, a lot of time thinking about self-driving cars. John Absmeyer, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. It's great to be here.
Are we on the road to this, or is this still a big question mark?
Well, we're absolutely on the road to it. I mean, a lot of things are driving that. Connectivity and people's desire to be connected all the time is creating more distractions in the car, and really people are demanding to have that connectivity. So what we're trying to do is address that market demand by offering more safe and connected systems.
You're talking about different levels of self-driving cars. Walk us through those, John, how the industry is thinking about it.
Sure. So actually, NHTSA's been kind enough to define those levels for us, and there's four levels. Really, zero. Level zero is no automation or mm-hmm. no ADAS systems or advanced driver active safety or assistance systems. Level one would be where you start to see some of the functions that have been on the road for years. Back in 1999, Delphi launched some of the first radar technologies that allowed active cruise control. And those types of systems would be considered level one. As you step up into level two, some of the systems that are coming on the road this year, even as soon as this year, where you have limited automation function in certain conditions, for instance, in good weather on the highway or in traffic jam conditions where you're under 30 miles an hour.
And what would happen? You're talking something semi-autonomous, like what would the car do?
Exactly. The car would take over control. It would let you know that maybe you're in a situation where it can drive. It would tell you or somehow notify you that it can take control, and you'd say, okay, go ahead, and it would drive you until it was time for you to take back over.
Now, who's making a car like that now, John?
Well, there's multiple car makers are announcing functions like traffic jam assist and highway automation, or really it's active cruise control with lane keeping.
Mm-hmm.
So multiple European and American OEMs have announced these technologies.
So if that's level two and it's with us, and I can kind of say, hey, I'm in a traffic jam, I'm going to kick back a little bit here, car, take over. What's level three, John?
Level three is a little bit more sophisticated system where maybe it can deal with more advanced situations like construction zones or certain levels of higher automation where maybe you get in the car and then you program in your navigation, and it can start to take control from lower speeds or from urban driving onto highway, for instance, or on the highway. If you're behind a slow-moving traffic, the car can make a lane change and go around that slower car, and so on. Level four then gets into point A to point B. You just jump in the car and tell it, I want to go to work, and it will take you there.
The auto industry predicted that decades and decades ago. It never came. Is it now getting concrete and real enough, John, that you think that will come? I hop into a pod, punch in a destination, do whatever I like, and show up there when I get there.
I think that is the long-term vision. I think the near-term is giving safety, taking care of some of the accidents and the road fatalities that some of the previous speakers mentioned, as well as the connectivity piece. So people want to have safety systems that allow them to have access to their content. So those near-term, level two and level three, are coming, in the next 5 years or so, over the next 5 years. Just like we saw the democratization of passive safety, which are safety systems that take care of you after the fact, after the accident, these systems are systems that anticipate and try to solve the problem before you have the accident. The best accident is the one that never happens. That's what our CTO continues to tell us. So, what we're trying to do is address that by making sure there are zero accidents.
Let me get a call right here from Meadville, Pennsylvania. Bob's calling. Hi, Bob. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I have two questions here. Mm-hmm. One is, what is the cost and maintenance of these cars after you buy it? In that, living in northwest Pennsylvania, as you're aware, there's a lot of snow, which
yes.
means there's a lot of salt, which means there's a lot of corrosion. So what is it going to take to maintain these systems? And if I'm in the middle of I-79 or I-90 and some decides to short out, where does that put me?
Let me pick those up with John Ebsmeyer. John, what do you say? Cost and, what about when it goes on the fritz?
Absolutely. Those are very relevant questions. Regarding the cost and maintenance, the automotive industry has been dealing with this for decades and, over a century. So the real issue is with respect to validation, making sure that these are tested and proven to work in all conditions. There'll be certain circumstances as we step up the ladder of automation where we won't be able to have, for instance, in the snow automation. And those were mentioned by some of the previous speakers. But really, the cost and maintenance should be in line with a car today, as long as we validate it to automotive-grade standards. And that's part of the solution that Detroit brings to the mix compared to some of the other tech companies that are trying to get in the space.
Because they have experience with, low-cost or highly cost-aware manufacturing?
Absolutely. And really, the conditions that occur in a car, right, the vibrations, the temperature cycles, the long-term use, and the various situations that cars come across on the road.
Burke Bilger, do you think you're going to jump into one of these self-driving pods in your lifetime?
Oh, yeah. I'm convinced of it. I think from what I saw driving around, I commuted with a Google engineer for about a week. Anyway, an hour and a half commute from Berkeley to Mountain View, California. And it was extremely smooth. I was shocked by that, actually. I thought it would be kind of a herky-jerky experience and lots of flubs and the driver taking over. But really, the car already on the highway was a better driver than I was.
Wow.
It has 360-degree vision with its laser turret on the roof. So it's really reading traffic patterns beautifully and responding to them before I would, because I can't see behind me or to my side.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Yes, a little Jetsons music there. It was all self-driving when George Jetson stepped in the pod. Maybe that's coming down to earth. We're talking this hour about the push to get cars talking to each other and then cars driving themselves. Google's been working on it, and not only Google. Last month, talking with Barry Peterson of CBS, Carla Bailo, Senior VP of Research and Development at Nissan America, said there's one big goal with a self-driving vehicle.
Safety. If your ultimate goal is zero fatalities, you have to have the cars being able to manage themselves and
zero
get rid of the human
fatalities.
Element. The final goal of autonomous should be zero.
Safety, says Nissan. It's not just Nissan. Here's Audi at the Consumer Electronics Show in Las Vegas last month. Bjorn Gisler, the project lead of the development of piloted driving at Audi, gave CNN a look at how a self-driven car might work.
You can just say, hey, I don't want to drive right now. Just take over. And if I want to be back in the driver's seat, I'll just grasp the wheel and go.
The car companies are working on this. Burkhard Bilger of The New Yorker magazine is with us. He's written big on this. You can link to his piece at our website. Bryant Walker-Smith is with us from Stanford University Law School. He is in the thick of the changes in law around self-driving cars. They are underway. John Absmeier is with us from Auburn Hills, Michigan today. He's director of the Silicon Valley Innovation Center for Delphi Automotive, the big Michigan-based auto supplier. Lots of calls for all three of you. Bob in Worcester, Massachusetts is calling. Bob, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. This worries me from a safety standpoint as far as the cars communicating with each other, because I've noticed, first of all, right now, most people aren't paying attention and aren't good drivers to begin with. And if they have these, you know, types of systems to fall back on, it's going to make people driving older cars, or especially driving motorcycles, it's going to put them in a lot more danger, because even on new motorcycles, for safety reasons, you couldn't have, say, braking assist or something like that. So, you know, people are going to be paying even less attention, and the risk for people in older cars is going to dramatically increase.
Bob, thanks for your call. Burke Bilger, what about it? I mean, the old way was you're the driver, you're responsible. The presumption is you must be fully attentive. Now with V2V, and never mind self-driving coming down the road, you get a kind of spectrum of expectations about how attentive you are. Maybe you don't feel as fully responsible. How are people thinking about that? The relationship on this spectrum of, you know, fully in charge to fully autonomous, how we're going to migrate and still all work together on the highway, Burke?
Well, I think it's definitely a concern. I mean, certainly people often bring the analogy of autopilot up, but pilots are trained very rigorously to be able to jump in at full awareness if there's any kind of a problem with the autopilot system. It's not clear how that's going to work with cars. At the same time, I think you have to admit that we've kind of turned this corner already. I mean, people are texting. They are going on their cell phones. There are younger people are less and less likely to get a driver's license at all, or to be well trained in driving. So, you know, this problem of distraction is an ongoing one, and I think, you know, I can't imagine that self-driving won't make drivers safer. I mean, yes, there'll be situations where, in the near term especially, we may need to take over and we won't be quite used to that transition. But, you know, certainly statistically, I imagine that'll be, you know, a small part of the gain we get from letting the car do more of the work.
John Absmeier, I wonder how the auto industry is thinking about drivers and all of this. I mean, here's a listener on Facebook, Mike, who says this is probably safer than a lot of human drivers. Today at a red light next to Mike, both the driver and the passenger in the car next to him were staring down at their phones. People already checking out on fully attentive, always on driving habits. But what about this migration to a different style of driving? Do you think it's coming, John? How do we deal with it along the way?
Absolutely. I think, you know, it can only get better. With the connectivity piece that I mentioned, people are more distracted. And as the caller said, you know, he's worried about people relying more on the technology. Well, that's what we're trying to make, is technology that you can rely on, right? So the idea is, as Bryant said, it has to be better than humans. So it can only get better from there. But the part about re-engagement is a really important piece. It's something that the industry is really trying to solve right now.
Meaning you're being driven along, suddenly there's something happens, a crisis, and you need to re-engage with the act of driving?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly right. Yeah, so how do you get the situational awareness to the driver? You know, for instance, if you're going around a corner at speed, how do you know how much torque to put on the steering wheel or how much throttle to apply to the pedal, et cetera? We have to create better human-machine interfaces. We have to create better user experiences in the car, in the cockpit, so that we can re-engage the driver and we can do it in a timely manner. So those solutions are right now in the development process.
Brian Walker-Smith, I've got listeners here. John says, oh, great, you know, this means I can sleep while I commute. Monica says, this suggests our cars can drive us home when we're drunk. This looks at self-driving cars as having just a passive passenger, not even really a driver there, Brian. Is the law prepared for that?
No, and I don't think the technology is prepared for that either. One of the real challenges in discussing these technologies and in framing public expectations is not promising too much. That the levels of automation we've described up to a fairly high point still require a human who is either monitoring or is able to return to the active driving task fairly quickly. And that's pretty incompatible with sleeping, as tempting as it will be.
Or drinking, and we know that's an issue already. Step at a time here, folks. Keep expectations lined up. On the other hand, there are big ambitions here. Mark in Shawnee, Oklahoma. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was just going to point out that, you know, one of the major impacts on our economic shift in the U.S. is that automation is taking over more and more middle-class jobs. And this will inevitably eliminate one of the few fields that's a well-paying job for an uneducated worker, which is truck driving. And, you know, due to the weight and size of those vehicles, if automated driving becomes, you know, something that you're finding on the road as a commonplace, those jobs will disappear, as well as so many others that automation has taken.
Mark, I think you're thinking like maybe a Google executive right now. Burke Bilger, you've talked with them. What about commercial applications? You've described Google's vision of almost high-speed, bumper-to-bumper trains of self-driven freight vehicles on the roads, Burke.
Yeah, I think Mark's right. I mean, you can't introduce a technology like this and not lose some human jobs, many human jobs. Google is already talking about potentially starting out with a robo-taxi service. You know, if they can't get a mainstream manufacturer on board to use their system, maybe they'll build their own kind of robo-taxis and have that as a beginning point. And
how would that work?
Taxi.
I mean, never mind Uber. I dial up what? A pod shows up. I step in. I speak an address and off we go?
Absolutely. I mean, that's the vision. Again, you know, you don't want to overpromise too soon. Mm-hmm. But Google, you know, they're very bullish on this. They think this is something they can have ready for prime time in 5 to 10 years. So, and yes, absolutely. You introduce a service like that, and how many thousands, millions, maybe taxi drivers lose their job? How many truck drivers lose their job? It's true. I mean, of course, that's been true of automation all along, and hopefully the idea is that new jobs crop up elsewhere. But that's you can't avoid that kind of downside.
Of course, we've heard that for a long time. New jobs elsewhere, and there have been some, but there haven't been enough. We're going to have some deep thinking to do about how to keep everybody employed or engaged or fed if we keep automating. Levi in Woodstock, Virginia. Levi, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I guess you can call me paranoid if you want, but I can see this technology being used against us, and I was wondering if any of your speakers could talk to the privacy issues and whether or not a car that can drive itself could be sort of commandeered by a third party, be that a corporation or a government.
Levi, you're not the only one thinking along those lines. I appreciate your call. I mean, Donnie writes to us, says, you know, the NSA can monitor every movement, and if one hacker gets into your system, control these cars, it would be disastrous. Here's a listener says, it's really about control. Laugh if you want, but vehicles that can drive themselves can be operated by a third party. This is just one step to turnkey totalitarian regime. Bryant, you're a legal mind. What do you think?
Thanks for thinking of totalitarianism in me, Tom.
Sure.
So three technologies we've been talking about, and I think it's important to distinguish them. The first is general connectivity to the cloud, vehicles communicating back to central servers to companies. That's happening already in the vehicles we buy today. The second is, as you mentioned, vehicle-to-vehicle communication, cars talking directly to each other. That's what the federal government's recent announcement concerned.
Yes.
And the third is increasing vehicle automation, driver assistance ultimately culminating in fully self-driving cars. That technology may or may not use the vehicle-to-vehicle communications that were the subject of this recent announcement. So all of those are happening at the same time, and they all raise different privacy and security concerns. Vehicles today, in some ways, are already vulnerable to hacking. There have been demonstrated attempts to break into today's cars.
To hack in to monitor where you're going or to actually put on your brakes?
To start affecting some of the systems.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been done occasionally remotely, other times with hardwire connections. But people know how to get into cars and cause some trouble if they spend enough time. As we're talking about greater connectivity and greater automation, the potential for that increases. I mean, to give you an example, Tesla already today can remotely change key operating characteristics of its vehicles. It has changed the ride height in response to some fire concerns. It has added an option to gradually creep forward at an intersection rather than stay still. And that's done already remotely. So the access already is pretty staggering to advanced vehicles. As we talk about increased communication of data and increased access, yes, the security concerns are increased, the privacy concerns vis-a-vis individual companies, vis-a-vis malicious individuals, and vis-a-vis government actors is increased, and the need for data validity, for the integrity of the data on which everyone is depending, is also increased. And these are very real challenges.
Burke Bilger, what about Google thinking about hacking? Are they worried about their self-driving cars being hacked and suddenly I'm not going to the grocery store, I'm going to God knows where?
Sure. I mean, I think the situations that Brian talked about are ones they've been monitoring closely. And it has been shown that, for instance, by hardwiring a laptop into a car, you can make the car yank the steering wheel out of your hands and drive into another car on the highway. And there have been, you know, some fairly dramatic stuff that can be done. And the Google engineers told me that, you know, even through something as innocuous as a tire pressure electronic situation, you can tap in and potentially affect the same kind of situations. So, again, it's a little bit like the distraction question. Yes, it's absolutely a vulnerability. On the other hand, we have that vulnerability already. And isn't it in some ways a positive thing that a company like Google and these other electronics companies are looking for ways to safeguard against that kind of intrusion? You know, Google's cars, I mean, they assured me would have multiple firewalls and levels of software protection, and they have these systems that self-monitor, you know, 100 times per second to make sure every system is has integrity. So I guess their argument would be, yes, you already have that danger, and we're going to help protect you against it more than make you more vulnerable to it.
John Ebsmeyer, you're with Delphi. I don't know, look down the road. If and when this comes to pass, do you worry about stepping into your car or whatever we call it at that point and being whisked away somewhere you don't want to go, John?
Well, certainly I'm concerned about that, and I think that that's the point, is that consumers are not going to adopt this technology if they fear for their privacy or security. I think that the answers around what Google is doing are exactly what's happening in the industry. We're creating firewalls, we're putting in software protections that will keep the user secure and their data private and their car safe. So absolutely, I would be concerned about that, but we are addressing that issue, and I don't think that it will cause a problem in the future.
Marianne in West Hartford, Connecticut. Marianne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Tom, I am vision impaired, mm-hmm. and I anticipate losing functional vision as I age.
Yeah.
I am considering the terrible loss of independence that not being able to drive is for the blind.
Sure.
Are there any attempts being made? Is there any focus now on technology that will help the blind?
Burke, what about it? Is Google thinking about potential drivers like Marianne, blind but still maybe served by a self-driving car?
Sure. I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that Florida was one of the first states to adopt this kind of law, because, you know, they have a large elderly population. And you look at the Google engineers themselves. I mean, Sergey Brin, one of the co-founders of Google, his parents are elderly, and he repeatedly told me that was one of the main reasons he wants to get this technology online quickly, is because he wants them to be able to go around in a car, have that mobility even as they get older. I know my mom, you know, has macular degeneration, mm-hmm. and hasn't been able to drive for about 5 years. And I would love for this to be ready for her. I doubt it will be, but I would love for it to be.
Bryant, the automobile, the car, for a century or more became synonymous with American liberty. I mean, you were in your car, you were master of your own destiny, you were driving wherever you wanted, you were in charge. Does that whole sort of poetry of the automobile, or even the liberty of the automobile, go away on this path?
In some ways, I think it's actually the opposite, that myth of the automobile providing absolute liberty has diminished as people have gotten more stuck in traffic, and as certain populations, the blind, some with physical disabilities, have been unable to avail themselves of individual mobility, and a result are stuck in a system in which that's the only option. Increasing automation could potentially help reverse that. I see it as dependency, by providing greater mobility to these populations, by potentially improving the efficiency of the transportation system. You know, the myth of the auto is something that's difficult to grapple with. 100 years ago, cars were the great environmental boon. They were going to be the green answer to cities. And so there's a lot of unexpected questions that they'll run into with these technologies, too.
Huge consequences. Many downsides with the automobile. Deep in the culture, though, and we'll see where this goes. John Absmeier, I'm thinking about the automotive companies. I mean, the experience of driving has been so key to the way they've marketed themselves. Now perhaps you'll just be driven. We'll check in again as all this evolves and migrates. John Absmeier with Delphi, joining us today from Auburn Hills, Michigan. John, thanks so much for your insights.
Thank you, Tom. It's been great.
Brian Walker-Smith at Stanford. Thanks a lot, Brian. Good luck to you.
Thank you, Tom.
And Burkhardt Bilger, staff writer for The New Yorker. You're great, Burke. Thanks for joining us today.
It's been a pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Happy driving while you do it. This is On Point.